Some of you are glowing with the glory of having been in the presence of the S-U-N rather than the S-O-N, but that is good. Now, what we're doing this evening, who are you, where are you? What can't men from Mars do? They can't multitask. So you're going to prove that book wrong, because all the women from Venus can do two things at once, easy peasy. But the men from Mars may struggle. We're going to do two things at once. While I just do a little bit of summary from this morning, if you can get yourself a pen, there is a form to fill in. Now, if you are a type A driven, you will hate this form. Because it looks like a test. And type A driven people want to know what is the highest score. Okay, how do I get the highest score? How do I win? Well, in this little thing you're doing, there are no winners and there are no losers. Sounds very kind of 21st century Britain, doesn't it? But it's a diagnostic. And what I'd like you to do is look at the question, and you see it's a very simple scoring system. You know, I am direct. I like to be direct. Naught, not at all. One, two, three. Three, very much. It's an instant. What's your instant answer to the question? Put a number down, okay? It doesn't need a lot of reflection. It doesn't need tons and tons of time. It just needs you to get through it, get a number down. You go through the whole of the question on the back sheet. You can fill in. You'll see a little table, and you can fill that one in and total it all up, and then we'll talk about what that means in a little while. So while you're doing that, men from Mars now multitasking, they're listening to me as well as filling in the form. Everybody got one? Anybody not got one? Anybody wish they could give their form back? No? Good. So, simple form, just fill it in. Okay? So, you've got a lot of things to think of. Now, what am I going to talk about while you're doing that? I just want to revisit a little bit this morning that idea of the three converts in Philippi and how that can help you as a church think about reaching different kinds of people in your community. It's not so much, are you involved in each of those three? But that may be helpful. But as a leadership, do you take seriously those three ways three ways of reaching different people? Are you equipping people to share their own faith personally whenever life circumstances give them an opportunity? Now we're going to look at that in a moment, this evening, in a bit more detail. Do you create a context in which people can invite friends to things? And some of the answer is yes, we do. So you've got your fun day and your carol services and things like that. But there may be other ways you can explore. And when you do come to a invite context, how many of you really, really put the boat out and go, do you know what, I could invite friends with a big smile to that? Many Christians are shy by nature. We're British, after all. Many of us not loud and so on. But has the whole concept of inviting people to things become part of your church's DNA? Even inviting people to church. Many Christians, I wouldn't invite anybody to church because they'd be scared stiff. Well, they might be, but the meeting of a church for worship on a Sunday is a powerful testimony to the love of God for us and to the love of one another in the family of God. It's very powerful. Remember how Paul said, if your worship is intelligible, he doesn't mean dumb it down, he doesn't mean seeker driven, he just means it's intelligible, then if God is working amongst you, the visitor will know it and will be convicted in his heart. God is really amongst you. And it is a very powerful challenge when you start seeing lots of non-Christians watching, overhearing the conversations that you have with God and God has with you through his preached word. Many churches today play down inviting friends to church because they think it's going to scare them off. And the third thing was, do you as a group plan for some kind of what Keller calls deed ministry, compassionate action that is done because it's good in itself? So remember how Galatians 6, do good to all people, especially the household of faith. There is no other, it doesn't need a justification. Do good to people as part of evangelistic strategy. No, he doesn't say that, he just says do good to people, because you're reflecting a heavenly Father who causes his sun to shine and his rain to fall on the good, the righteous and the unrighteous. So, for example, you might, we've run a thing that helps people get out of debt. And we help people, whether they show interest in spiritual things or not, whether they come to church or not, whether they convert or not. It is still a good thing if people can be freed from debt. It helps the community flourish. Everybody's a winner. But in so doing, you often find in acts of compassion that people say, this God you believe in, can I find out more about him? And that's how you reach slave girls, or the equivalent today. So, you know, you mean to go home and say, as a church member or a church person, have a chat with your leaders and say, have we got those three working well in our church? Are they part of our DNA? When we all come to Christmas carol service, do most of us encourage one another to invite friends along? Or is that just the odd person that does it? That kind of thing. So that's quite an important, seems to me. Luke is being descriptive in Acts 16. He's not being prescriptive. He's not saying you must do this or else. But we'd be very foolish if we didn't understand just how significant that little descriptor of those three conversions in Acts 16 is. The gospel comes to Europe, and this is how Europeans come to faith. They don't all come to faith the same way. So let me give an example. A church I know quite well said to me once, do you know what? All our eggs are in children's outreach. All our evangelistic eggs are in children's outreach work. We're not seeing many adults saved. And I said, well, you won't. Because all your eggs are in the children's outreach work. Partly because it's a lot easier to get a crowd of kids together to listen to stories about Jesus. Not a bad thing. A lot of adults converting will say, oh, I used to go to a children's work or a Sunday school or something. So it's not a bad thing. But you're not going to see many. You won't see many blokes converted like that. You know the stats from America? If you see a child converted, there's only something like 8% likelihood that you'll get the parents converted. If a wife gets converted, there's something like 20% chance that somebody else in the family will get converted. If a husband gets converted, over 90% likelihood that somebody else in the family will get converted. It's incredible, isn't it? So where does the church do all its work? With children. It should be working on men. You go for the guys, you get the wife and the children. You go for the children, you don't get anybody. But it's hard to get the men, so we don't. And that's just pragmatism, I know. It's just pragmatic, it's only statistics. But if you only do children's outreach work and you don't train people to talk to jailers, you don't get jailers converted. So let me ask you, last time, when was the last time a fairly ordinary, working class, tough, middle-aged man got converted in your church? In our church, rare. It's rare. We've had a few now, and it's brilliant when they get converted. They're so straightforward. Right, okay, got it, yeah, okay, go and tell me, mates. This is great. Well, when was the last time the equivalent of a slave girl got converted? Well, any of you fish? Any of you go fishing? Any of you fishermen? I don't understand fishing. I'm like one of those guys that throw it in a, come on, fish, come on, get out of it, I can't wait all day. But the fishermen, I know, they're patient, but they use different kind of baits, different type of fish, don't they? Well, in our pond in Leicester, there are all kinds of different fish swimming around. Some of you know, I know what we do, right? We throw in a hand grenade, kills the lot, they all come to the surface, we catch everything, but they're dead fish then, aren't they? So how do we land people? So that's what we were talking about this morning. And many church leaders I've talked to, when they think about it, they go, do you know what? We aren't intentionally going for anybody. We just, do you know what church leaders do? They just shout louder. Come on, church! And you go, okay, and nothing happens, so they shout louder. You often find that the decibels from the pulpit go up. Not a great idea. So just have a think about that as a church. It's being a bit provocative, but if you want to see jailers and slave girls as well as Lydia's, you've got to just think about it in different ways. You've got to create what we call multiple entry points. Okay, multiple entry points. The evangelical church in Britain has tended to have a single entry point. It's been Sunday evangelistic preaching. It's pretty cerebral. That's fine if you're that way wired. It assumes a phenomenal amount of knowledge, which is now no longer there. How many watch Universally Challenged, as my friends call it? How many of you watch that? Have you noticed that the biblical questions are getting fewer, and when they come, blank, complete blank? Because the people who write the questions are my age. The people who answer them are your age. And in that 30 to 40 years, there's been a phenomenal cultural shift. Those of you, remember how RE at school at my age was Bible, Bible, Bible. RE at school today, well, it's still a great muckabout lesson, isn't it? I mean, if you're a bloke, music, art and RE, muckabout lessons. But no? Weren't you not like that? Come on. This is so bad. Boys like me were teachers' nightmares. But do you know what? Do you know what? I still remember the lessons. Even though we were mucking about, we still remember them. But now, there isn't that background. There isn't that background. And the church still thinks it is. So when it does its stuff, so its entry point is like one door only. And we need multiple entry points. That's what Luke is saying. Okay, so while I've been talking, all you men from Mars and ladies from Venus have filled this in, yeah? Okay, so on the back sheet, does it all make sense what you're doing? Have you finished it yet? What you should have is a load of figures on the back bit of paper, and along the bottom, you should have some totals, yeah? Have you got that? Has everybody got some totals along the bottom? Okay. Now, this is the lesson. If you're still finishing it off, don't worry, you can do it. The lesson is not what is the pass mark. The lesson is you will probably have a variation along the bottom figure. It doesn't matter if you've got 18s or 12s or 6s. It doesn't matter. Is that very rarely will you have a whole neat row of all the same. What you've just done is self-diagnose the kind of personality you are. So, okay, how many of you scored? The straightforward, you know, speak from the heart, then engage the brain type person. How many of you like that? Jenny, you are, because I know you've done this before, so put your hand up. One or two, okay, all right, it's fine. Intellectual, anybody, was that their highest score, intellectual? Okay, one or two of you, yeah, I thought you might be, okay. Testimonial, anybody that, okay, guy at the back, yeah. Interpersonal, just good with people, oh, quite a few of you, yeah, okay. Invitational, yeah, one or two, okay. Serving, okay, now look, this is really encouraging, right. Why is this important? Because we tend to think that evangelism is done by people with a certain personality. And if you've got that personality, that's, you know, God has given you the gift of evangelism, and I'm not like that. So, you know, I'll pray for you, brother or sister, but you're an evangelistic type and I'm just not. Well, what this says, right, let me think of somebody. In the Bible, straightforward, sometimes got himself into a lot of trouble, got rebuked quite sternly once, for not quite getting it before he opened his mouth. But, when God wanted the sermon preached that brought X thousand into the kingdom, he chose Peter. Peter was a straightforward sort of guy, you know, wore his heart on his sleeve, always saying things that is, oh no, Peter again, oh no, do you know? But God used him, didn't he? Martin Luther would have scored highly here, wouldn't he? Could you imagine being Martin Luther's parents? What a nightmare to try and bring up Martin Luther. And yet, by the time he was a grown-up guy, God used that passion and that strength to turn Europe round. Okay, intellectual. Somebody in the Bible who loves debating. Middle of the day, it's hot, but hey, the lecture hall's free, so let's go and have a good discussion. His name? Paul. Paul was the classic intellectual. He just loved. Now, what do people do in Southern Europe at midday? They go to sleep. But not if you're intellectual and somebody wants a discussion. I'll meet you in the lecture hall of Tyrannus for 2 whole years every day. Paul loved it. He just loved it. And you might be like that. You say, like, not a crowd person, but if someone wants to talk about dialectical materialism, how relevant that Marxist theory of life is today, oh, I'd love a discussion. Or, you know, is postmodernism now post? Well, I don't know. Whatever. You just love it. Great. Testimonial. A man said, I don't know a lot, but I know this. I was, and now I can. John 9, man born blind. Just could tell his story. He could just tell his story. He could say, look, I was like this, and I'm now like this, and Jesus did it. And there's sometimes, you know, it may lack a little bit of finesse, but nobody questions the sincerity. Okay, interpersonal. Guy in the Bible, good with other people, great encourager, one of my heroes. Barnabas. Joseph, who nicknamed Barnabas because he was the son of encouragement. He just had that ability to put people at ease. He was the one who, when Paul was being, he's dodgy, Barnabas said, no, come on, in you come, join. Great with people. Invitational. Man in the Bible, every time you meet him, he's grabbing somebody and saying, come and meet Jesus. First thing he did when he met Jesus, what did he do? Went and got his brother. You've got to come and meet Jesus. What's his name? Andrew. Andrew, every time you meet Andrew in the Gospels, Simon, come and meet Jesus. Later on, when the Greeks wanted to meet Jesus, who did they go to? They went to Philip and Andrew, because Philip and Andrew were great invite people. We have a lady in our church called Carol. She lives on a caravan park, you know, one of those places which, you know, dodgy landlord and all the rest of it. And yet, if we say, Carol, we've got something coming on. She's like a rent-a-mob. She's brilliant. She just goes around the whole of the caravan park saying, right, our church is doing this. Come on, you're coming. She's like, just people say, yeah, all right, Carol. She just brings crowds of people to things. Serving, lady in the church, everybody cried when she died. Dorcas. See, now, there are people in the Bible just like you, who God used mightily. He just used them as they were. And in your church, God has placed all of these different kinds of people. And that is fantastic, isn't it? Because you say, look, I'm not an intellectual, but I know a man who is. Or I'm not very good at bringing people, but when they come, I'll give them a warm welcome. You see, God has placed us all in the family and say, you don't have to be who you're not. You can be who you are. And if you're a straightforward person, well, my son, he must have heard the gospel loads and loads and loads of times, but he needed a bloke in his late 20s, talking to my son in his early 20s, he said, come on, Richard, get yourself sorted out. You know this. It's about time you ask Jesus to be your saviour. I've been praying for that kind of straightforward conversations you do as parents. You know you can't do as parents because, you know, they might never talk to you ever again. But when somebody else did it, it needed someone who were straightforward but loving with it. And our son was converted through a very straight conversation. Others, they need their questions answered. They go, look, I've got it, but I've got a lot of the questions. And you feel, oh, I'm out of my depth, but there'll be somebody else God has placed in your church. See, you can be on the pitch and in the game in terms of God using you just the way you are wired. You don't have to have a personality change. You don't have to be different from who you are, because you look at your sort of, now some of you will have two or three areas which you're quite strong in, and that's great. The lesson is, be who you are. Some of the areas which are kind of lower down, you could work at them. So you may say, look, I scored very low on invitational. That's not me at all. Okay, fair enough. But even you could give an invite out at carol service time, couldn't you? You could now. So you could make that one a little bit stronger. Those of you who are not very good at serving, that's not your natural bent. You know, I'm not going to pick up the hymn books or whatever you... But you could just do a little bit more to touch people's lives by action. You see, but we don't have to be fundamentally other than who we are. Because God used someone just like you in the Bible. Now, once you accept that, most Christians, you know, the motivation for sharing the faith is guilt. Many preachers, when they talk about sharing the faith, work hard to make you feel guilty. You can often come away thinking, uh-oh, I'm getting like beaten up again by the preacher at the front. And that doesn't get very far, does it? Most of us don't serve God effectively if we are driven along by a sense of failure, inadequacy, and guilt. We're not. We just don't. I used to feel evangelism, like I paid to do this, okay? And I used to feel evangelism like, put them in, oh no, not again. I've got to evangelize somebody. That's how negative it was in my mind. Now, I'd never say that, I'll tell it to you publicly, but I wouldn't say that publicly, but that's how it felt to me. It felt something like, it goes against my natural temperament. I have to be, Becky Manlett-Pippert put it like this, she said, it felt like I had to be obnoxious to somebody. Evangelism was something I wouldn't even do to my dog, let alone to my friends. That's how it felt. Whereas she began to accept who she was and that God could use her in her sense of weakness, and she trusted herself to him. And that could be true of you. And this is called the Evangelism Styles Questionnaire. It's a Bill Hybels thing. It's almost a bit of fun, really, okay? It's nothing technical or scientific or, you know, but it just says God has wired us all differently. Some of us have traits that are like people in the Bible, of people that God used. So if he could use them, then he can use you now just as you are. Okay. Let's move on. Next bit. Equipping for go and tell. So we talked this morning about come and see, go and serve, care and serve, and go and tell. Go and tell is where God uses you through life, through a conversation like we're saying this morning. You know, it's a depth conversation might just come, and in the middle of it all, somebody might just say, well, okay, what's your story then? How do you become a Christian? Now, do you need to learn how to tell your own conversion story? Answer, no. Do you need to learn how to tell your conversion story? Answer, yes. It's a no and yes. There's no thou shalt, thou, you know, you must. But again, in Acts, Luke gives us Paul's story three times. For Luke, it's really important. This is how Paul got converted. Each time, you get exactly the same structure. This is what I was like before. This is what happened to me, and this is what's happened since. Three times with exactly the same structure, in three different contexts. We just saw Paul, in effect, on trial. And he gives this formal defense, if you like, his apologia for being a Christian before a hugely important authoritative audience. But he uses the same basic format. Now, we've talked to people at home about this and say, in your lifetime, if you're living your Christian life, you may well get the opportunity to share your story. Why blow it? Why be so tongue-tied and confused and use subcultural jargon and go all over the place? It takes 45 minutes. You don't get 45 minutes, rarely, to tell your own story. You get a couple of minutes. Could you succinctly tell your story in a couple of minutes? And most Christians, let me tell you this. We preachers think that if we pass information that way, you get it. No. When we did this at home, I said, what you're going to do now is I just want you to think about how you became a Christian, you know, just in a couple of minutes. Just share with the person on your right your story. And this afterwards, this lady came up to me. She's probably in her late 70s. She had been a Christian over 50 years. She said, Ray, I can't. I just don't know what I would say. And I thought, you know what? You will have heard thousands of sermons. I know this lady. She's a lovely, lovely lady. I love her to bits. She would have heard thousands of sermons, but she'd never, ever practiced sharing her faith. And when we come to say, just tell your story, I just can't do it, I can't do it. She'd got all that knowledge this way, but she'd never practiced it. And so she felt incredibly uncomfortable. Who was she going to tell her story to? Her husband. Her husband. The person on her right was her husband. I can't do it, I'm too embarrassed. Thinking, oh my goodness, he's your husband, he's a Christian, we're only practicing. You know, why would your heavenly Father let you loose on a real person when, humanly speaking, what is the outcome? What is at stake? Hell or heaven is at stake here. Incredibly. We get more. How many can drive? Most of you can drive. How many took driving lessons before you learned to drive? Most of you. Okay? The government wouldn't let you out on the road. And yet, how many of us are willing to just learn a little bit about how to share our faith? Most of them, I'm not going to do that. The government makes you learn to drive, and your heavenly Father says, it's a good idea to learn how to share your faith. Because when it's for real, the outcomes are phenomenally serious. Why am I standing here before you tonight? Because a friend at school shared his faith with me. Humanly speaking, he hadn't shared his faith, I wouldn't be here. I've got the theology, I'm a paid up Calvinist and all the rest of it. I know that, okay? But humanly speaking, that's what brought me to faith. A friend sharing his faith, gave me a book, became a Christian. So what we're going to do now is just turn to the person on your right. And I'm just going to spend, okay, 2 minutes sharing your story. Now, hold on. This is the bit you need to know. Listen, shh. You share your faith, then we'll swap, and then you share your faith back. 2 minutes, no jargon. Now, this is what you need to know. I have cunningly wired every chair. And if I hear any jargon that a normal person won't understand, I have a buzzer back here, and you will jerk. And if I really did, most of the room would be jerking all over the place, wouldn't it? Because we aren't good at this. Now, you might go, oh, Ray, this is like childish. But let me tell you this. When I have done this myself, and when I've encouraged other Christians to do it, in the coming week, maybe on Monday morning when it's for real, the numbers of people came back to me, I can't believe it. I had the opportunity to share my story this week. How scary was that? My God, you know, if we hadn't done that prep, I'd have been all over the place. So yeah, your heavenly Father knows. He's already got some conversations lined up this week. Now, it might not be all of you, but some of you this week might get the opportunity to tell your story. Mrs. Schaefer, Edith Schaefer is one of my great, great authoress here. She writes stuff about life. She said, you know, we don't wake up with the angels singing in our ears saying, today is the day when you share your story and it'll be significant. You don't. You're just doing your ordinary things, you know, cleaning, changing nappies, cleaning the car, fixing light bulbs, and some conversation comes up and it could be a eternity changer. So, okay, 2 minutes to the person next to you. Just share your faith. if you can, using this before, during, and after, jargon-free, 2 minutes. Okay? Let's go. Ready? Go! Now, it's very important this. When you're telling your story, it is your story. You don't have to think, like, what do they need to hear? It's your story. That's the legitimizing fact. It's your story. They may not agree or believe you, but it is your story. And that's why you don't have to think, right, so, you know, the person who's listening to this, whereas a preacher might want to adapt a lot of his material to help somebody's understanding, when you tell your story, it's just your story, and that's okay. You can tell your story. They may have no religious background at all. You might have been brought, Jenny was a born and bred, strict and particular Baptist. Okay? She went to church 3 or 4 or 5 times a Sunday. Okay? So she got converted when she was 14 or 15. Now, she had a very religious upbringing. I had a very irreligious upbringing. Could Jenny, from a very religious upbringing, talk to somebody from a very irreligious background, tell a story? Yes, you can. Because you say, I was born up in a very religious home. Thought it was about keeping rules. And I discovered somewhere in my early teens that it isn't about keeping rules. It's all about what God has done for me. Sending Jesus to die for my rebellion on the cross. And I asked him to forgive me. Now, I'm an irreligious person. That tells me a little bit about you and your background. But it isn't my background, but that's okay. It doesn't have to be my, that's not my story. But you see, you're telling me how Jesus' story and your story crossed over somewhere. And that makes me go, oh, how interesting. Oh, I didn't know that. You see? So you don't have to sort of, you don't have to justify yourself. You don't have to try and glamorize it either. We once had a couple, Paul and Felicia. Felicia had this one of these like, took all day, but you know, parents are split up. They were Jewish. They split up. They got separately saved. They bumped into each other. They got remarried and blah, blah, and on and on and it went. And she had this one of like these amazing conversions. She was high on drugs and she got saved from that and just blah, and on it went. Then her husband Paul got up and said, "Well, you know, I suppose I got the most boring story out. I was about 8 years old when I asked Jesus to forgive me. That's about it, folks." Afterwards, everybody said, "That touched me more. That really touched me. That boring, I haven't got any frills to tell you, but Jesus forgave me my sins." So you don't have to have a dramatic story. It's your story. How did it feel telling it to somebody you knew? Okay? Okay, most people okay about it? Clear? Has it helped having a before, during and after? It's worth thinking about that. Before, during and after. And you can be honest about the after bit. You know how Paul said, "Since then I've been going around telling people, and they haven't wanted to listen, that Jesus is the light to the Gentiles." That's when Festus went, "You're insane, Paul." It's okay, you can say, "Since I became a Christian, well, it's been hard." And sometimes the hard bit of since you become a Christian touches people's lives more than if, "Oh, my life's been wonderful." In our family, our son and daughter lost a child at 3 days old. And they tell their story. You know, we became Christians when we were in our teens and happily married. And we've been a follower of Jesus. And, you know, it's not been easy. We lost our first child. And that gets under people's radar. Then if you said, "Oh, we're happy and, you know, everything's wonderful and we won the lottery. Oh, we shouldn't play the lottery. But we did win the lottery." You know, if they told a story like that, people go, "Okay, you don't understand." Whereas sometimes the suffering of your life, the difficulties since becoming a Christian, people go, okay. So, that's your story. Now, what we're going to do very briefly here is, how do you tell his story? Tell your story, but how do you tell the gospel story? Now, we're in great danger here. I just don't want to make you feel as if this is like evangelism for people who wear nappies. You know, it's not like that. But I just found these, like, I come from a bit of an academic background, and I, on that evangelism styles thing, that was my highest score, you know, intellectual. Sounds arrogant, but it's just the way I'm wired. But over the years, with people, I found having some of these ready to use, if necessary, has really helped me. Now, every now and then, I get into a really involved deep discussion, And I don't want people to feel we're trying to be simplistic, dumbed down, you know, don't ask questions, we Christians haven't got any answers. It's not like that at all. You know, sometimes you need that long conversation. As Dr. Schaefer said, you know, you talk through worldviews and all the rest of it for hours. That's sometimes really, really significant. But in my experience, and the experience of many people I've talked to, they are way down track when you've drip-fed some of the gospel story in. So we're just going to do, we won't get through all these, I'll just do a couple of these. One of the biggies, certainly in a town like Bedford, certainly in a town like Leicester, is what about all those other faiths? Okay, comes up in many shapes and forms, this question. It can be an assertion, religion, you know, causes all the trouble. And then, or it could be like, how can you say Jesus is the only way? Or what about all the other faiths? You know, look, that kind of question. And many Christians, they feel out of their depth. Very interesting. If you come to my house, you go past this enormous building. It's about three times the size of where we are. It's huge. People go, oh, isn't that a big mosque? I go, it's a gurdwara. What's one of those? Say, well, you're already insulted all the people that go there. See? It's for Sikhs. That's the mosque, actually, just there. 50 yards away is a mosque. Actually, that's the Pakistani mosque. You better not tell them people. That's not the Bangladeshi mosque, okay? Because the Bangladeshi Muslims and the Pakistani Muslims, they're not best of friends. So you've got to get that one right. And already Christians go, I'm already lost. You know, I'm already confused. You know, is it the Muslims that eat pork or is it the Hindu? Oh, no. So as soon as you start talking comparative religion, unless you really specialize in that, many Christians feel, I'm going to keep out of that one because I'm just going to get it. I'm going to make a serious mistake here. And you can, you know, because you can really cause a lot of offense. But there is help at hand. And this is what we've helped people, is this. How's it? Any question that comes up about comparative religion, other faiths, Jesus being the only way, or even religion is the cause of all the trouble in the world, you say this. Okay, all right, you say. Just let me help you understand it. How do you spell religion? How do you spell religion? You spell religion. This is how you spell religion. You spell religion D-O. That's how you spell religion. All the religions in the world are about what people do. Now, you might have a little bit of insider knowledge. So my friend next door, you don't want to be a Muslim at the moment because Ramadan is coming into June. Do you know what that means? My neighbor will not eat from 3 a.m. till nearly 1 o'clock the next morning. He just won't eat. He won't drink either. He'll do that for a whole month. Ramadan in the Northern Hemisphere in June is no fun at all. But it's something he has to do. It's something he has to do. He's done the Mecca bit. He's been there. He's come back. He's, you know, but the fast is massive. Now, that might be a religion which has a lot of rules. But it might be very, well, you know, my religion hasn't got any rules. I just like to meditate. So you have to meditate, do you? Well, you know, I kind of like to. Something you do. Whether religion is very formal or very informal, all the world's religions, all of them, are about what you do. Now, you know what's coming next, don't you? How do you spell Christianity? Yeah, you know how it's spelled. You spell Christianity, D-O-N-E. It's what's been done for you. That's why Christianity is unique. It is not about what we Christians do. It's what's been done for us that we depend on and rely on. And that makes all the difference. Now, for most Brits, that is revelatory. Because they assume this. They say, this is how they think. Get this. This is really, really important. They think they are irreligious and you are religious. And they think the gospel is become a religious person like me. That's what they think the gospel is. They only think there are two ways to live. In fact, there's that little mischievous little tract, isn't there? Two ways to live. Kind of know where it's coming from. It's unhelpful because they already think that. My way, irreligious, don't care about God. And your way, religious. And the good news is become a religious person like me. And we have to work so hard to say, no, no, there are three ways to live. There is an irreligious way, keep God out. Then there's a religious way, try to earn God's acceptance by what you do. And then there's Christianity, which is a completely different third way. It is about God's love that I don't have to earn or deserve, and what has been done for me. Now that, little do and done, that will help most Christians deal with most of the issues they're going to face that come up to do with Jesus being the only way, all religions the same, you know, how could you say your faith, religion is the cause of all the wars in the world, and all that sort of stuff. Do and done. Now you already, now you can say, oh, I could do that. And that will help most people. It will, even very religious people. So well, actually Christianity is not about all that I have to do. It isn't. It is about what's been done for me. It's why it's so different. Isn't that? I mean, that's taken me 2 minutes. You could have been studying Islam for years and still not be able to help a Muslim more than do and done. Isn't that helpful? Our folks have found it phenomenally helpful. They thought, oh, I wish I'd been told that in the first few years of my Christian life. I've gone years and years scared stiff of ever sharing my faith with a Muslim or a Hindu because I don't know the difference between them, Ray. And when I did know, I've forgotten all the important bits. But now I can just share simply about Jesus. Okay? Now, that, I don't want to dumb it down, but you'd be amazed how helpful that one is. Okay. I haven't got time to do the bridge diagram. How many of you know the bridge diagram? Many of you know? Some of you know? Teach it. Okay? Learn what the bridge diagram is. Tell them why. Let me tell you why. How many of you are visual learners? Any graphic designers here? Visual learners. Not just, but visual learner. One or two visual learners. Let me tell you a story. My son Chris, he must have heard the gospel almost, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. Then on, when he was in his 15th year, one Sunday at church, I said, well, I'm going to share the, I want to tell you about the gospel story. But I'm going to do it slightly differently tonight. Got a big whiteboard out and I did the what's called the bridge diagram. I drew the diagram. He got converted when he saw it. He heard it explained, but as he saw it, I thought, oh, one off. I've got another guy, Luke. He's just finishing fine art course in London. He's now about 21, 22. He came to a Christianity Explored. He got converted when I did the bridge diagram because he's a visual learner. And it was a real rebuke to me because I'm not a visual learner. My son has been drawing doodles of my sermons, all his spider diagrams since he was a baby. And I thought, of course, he's a visual learner. That's how he best gets his information. He's now a designer. He does branding. He's in the visual industry. Now, he needs an audio comment to reinforce what he can see. Now, if you come across a visual learner, they just don't get it. I mean, how many of you love reading? Just a few of you. I have a son who won a book prize for PE when he was 15 years old. You know what he said to me? Dad, I don't do books. You give me the money, you have the book prize. I said, no, I'm not. I know. I get a book allowance from my church. I've got thousands. I don't need your book prize. It sat on the shelf 7 years till I gave in. That's how much he doesn't do books. Okay? He waited till I gave in. I said, all right, there's the tenner. I'll have the book token. He doesn't do books. Now, what do you do if you're in a person who doesn't do books? He's audio. He'll listen to a story. But you give him a book to read, he'll never touch it. Just doesn't do books. How did he get through GCSE English? Do you know how? We got books, audio books on tape out the library. He never read a thing. He just listened to them. Still got through. Amazing. But that's how he did it. He just doesn't do books. Whereas for me, if you'd come along to tell me your Christian story in a meeting, I'd have never come to anything like this. Never in a thousand years. Give me a book, I'll read it any day of the week. Read it in the next half hour if you want. I read fast. See, we're all different. The bridge diagram helps visual learners. So it's worth learning how to do it. Because you might be with somebody who just, could you show me that? Could you just show me? I'm not a sequential learner. I just like to see it. Well, how are you going to share the faith if you don't know how to show somebody? And some people just need that kind of help. Bridge diagram does that. Take five. Bible, big book. Any of you started reading the Bible before you became a Christian? No? One or two of you. Okay. Where did you start? Where do you start with the book? You start at the beginning. How far do you get through the Bible when you start at the beginning? Exodus 19, guaranteed stop sign. It's great, interesting stories, and all these people killing each other. And, you know, they've gone up to Egypt, and oh, it's really fascinating. Till you get to what? The law. You kind of get through the Ten Commandments, you go, okay. And then, oh my goodness! Because nobody tells you the Bible is a library. And it has a story, but it's quite complex, isn't it? So what do you do with somebody who says, look, I picked up a Bible, I just don't get it. I just don't get it. Could you explain the Bible to me? How would you do it? How would you do it? Could you explain the Bible story simply? And the answer for most Christians is no. I could tell you about Jesus. I could tell you there's a bit in the beginning called the Old Testament and the New Testament. And it's the bit before Jesus and the bit after Jesus. But I could explain it if I had enough time. Well, we've taught children this one. It's called Take Five. It's so straightforward, but it's helpful. The Bible in five little comments. Okay, here we go. Whole Bible. God set it up. Everything. Genesis chapter 1 and 2. God set it up. We messed it up. Genesis chapter 3. We messed it up. Everything has been wrong since we messed it up. That's why you know when you turn on the news, it's going to be bad news. Why? Because we live in a messed up world. You know that what the Bible says is true. You live in a messed up world. From Genesis chapter 4 right through to the whole of the rest of the book of the Bible called Malachi, which a non-Christian would pronounce Malachi, as you would, wouldn't you? You would. Malachi, the Italian prophet. Okay. Malachi, God calls us back. It's basically God calling us back. We're not listening. We're not listening, but God is calling us back. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, number 4, God came himself. God has come. As Lewis, yes, brilliant. God has come to this enemy-occupied territory. But we didn't recognize him. But he came. God came himself. Then there's a choice. The Bible gives us a choice. If I believe and follow Acts to Jude, God grows relationships. That's why if you read the Bible, you're reading somebody else's mail. That's why you don't understand it, because it's a love letter from a father to a son or a daughter. All those letters are love letters from a father to his children. And if you're not one of his children, that's why you don't understand it. Somebody else's letter. It's for those who follow as Jesus. But what if I don't? Revelation, God sorts it out. God will sort it out one day. Whole Bible in five. You could use that, can't you? If somebody really wanted to say, look, let me just explain. God set it up. We messed it up. God called us back. God came himself. If I believe and follow, God grows relationships. But if I don't believe, God will still sort it out. See, that's doable, isn't it? You see, it's doable. You can put that one up your sleeve and think, right, if I really did have the opportunity, I could do that. This one, three crosses. Anybody ever come across any of this? Three crosses? Okay. What I want you to do is just, if you can, with your bit of paper, fold it like so you've got three crosses like that. Okay? Just fold it so bottom up like that. Now, I put this easy for you, but now, what you need with your pen is what I want you to do. I'm not doing it on here because I'm... Colour that one like that, and that one like that, okay? So you should have, it doesn't need to be accurate, you can have two crosses like that. Two black, one white. Okay? Now, you say, this is so basic, Ray. The people you are talking to today, by and large, we met a bloke in Bedford about 10 years ago. We asked him a question. We're doing a questionnaire thing. What do you think of the death of Jesus? How do you think he died? And he said, white English said, well, he died of old age, didn't he? White English, Jesus died of old age. Never heard about it. We had another lady, 42 years old. She's been coming to church now for about 3 years, not a Christian yet. 18 months in to hearing us talk, been through two explore courses, she said, do you mean to say Jesus actually lived? I thought it was like Father Christmas. White English. So don't assume people know. anything today. So it may, I'm not dumbing down, but this is a helpful, somebody says, look, okay, I've heard Jesus, but I don't get the thing about dying on the cross. I don't get it. We use this one. When Jesus died, he was crucified with two other blokes. They were like thieves. Probably better translation would be, we would see them as terrorists. We would see them as, you know, involved in violent acts that warranted a death penalty. And there they are. The three of them were converted. Three of them were crucified. Two men convicted by the Roman authority for being, you know, evil guys, and Jesus. And the only reason Jesus Christ is being crucified is because he claimed to be the Son of God. Nobody can make any other claim stick. The only reason Jesus has been crucified is because he claimed to be the Son of God. Nobody could find anything wrong. Now, as the crucifixion happened, these two men, both, like everybody else, rejecting Jesus, moaning at Jesus, complaining at Jesus, you know, criticizing Jesus. But as the period went on, this one of these men, let's call him this man, he began to think seriously about his life and his death and his future. And he had a profound change of mind. He began to say, stop moaning at Jesus. We are getting what we deserve. We deserve justice. This man begins to realize that he's under God's judgment. In a few moments' time when he dies, he's going to meet God as his judge. And he knows he's lived an evil life. He turned to Jesus at that point and said to Jesus, when you become the king, remember me. And Jesus turned to him and said, today you will be with me in paradise. Jesus forgave him everything. Now what is happening? Slip this one down. And this is what we say. This is where you say, this is what is happening. This is what is happening. This man and Jesus, as it were, swap. Their whole, Jesus, Son of God, swaps his status, as it were. He takes the blame for what this man has done. So that this man is treated as Jesus should be when he dies. I play sport, I sometimes use this illustration, I hate being substituted. Evans, get off, get off. You know, your time, oh no. But this is the most wonderful substitution imaginable. Jesus substitutes himself and takes the full blame for this man's rebellion against God. And this man is treated as if he's one of God's sons. That's the Christian gospel. That's what the cross is all about. Now, okay, I know it's simple. There's tons of stuff you've left out. But you see, for a visual learner, they can see two black crosses and one white cross. And you say, and which is your cross? Which is your cross? For me now as a Christian, that's my cross. That's my cross. I asked Jesus, would he die for my sins? And he would. And though I've rebelled against God, Jesus has taken the blame for me. Which is your cross? See? Now, you see, that's okay. That's simple, I know. But for the people around us today, they may never, ever, ever have heard any explanation about the cross of Jesus Christ. So there's some simple how you can tell his story. And with a little bit of effort, you could kind of, I don't say mug them up and sort of, you know how Jehovah's Witnesses are? Do you ever get Jehovah's Witnesses on? They stop visiting my house. We've kind of got the, you know, we've got the kind of lurgy on them now. Because they get fed up talking to me. But you know, every now and then, they get stuck. And what do? They reach into, you know, you ever wonder what's in those bags? It's the answers book for when they meet an evangelical Christian. Because when you, so it's, oh, you know, the doctrine of the Trinity. And I go, okay, how much do you really know about the Athanasian Creed? And they get their book out and they go, let me read the book. Oh, that is not what this is. This is not a kind of mug it up, but it's just let it be yours naturally. And you imagine how many of you in the room tonight, 60 people, have now just been given 1, 2, 3, possibly 4 simple explanations of the gospel. You can imagine the angels from heaven watching, going, this is going to be a great week. They've just been given phenomenal tools. You know, God is just like, I'm a Royal Air Force background. You're like tornado jets loaded up with 1,000-pound bombs, you know, apart from the fact that the bombs you're going to drop are going to do people good. We sing that sword, don't we? Song, it's a lovely song, isn't it? The sword that makes people whole. The only sword that makes people whole. And you've just been given some of them. So, wow. Wouldn't it be exciting in a couple of weeks' time to know what God the Holy Spirit can do? Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm sort of being slightly, you know. But it's just amazing the number of Christians that willingly say, I'll learn some simple ways of showing my faith. Come back and say, I had a brilliant opportunity. That do be done. Wow. That's amazing. Go, yeah, I know. It's pretty cool, isn't it? It's simple. What a way to start a conversation. Right. Final little bit. We've got 5 minutes. Encouraging, come and see. What does this mean? Okay. Do you know what this diagram is? Anybody know what that diagram is? It's on the back of your sheets. What's the diagram? Okay, let me tell you. This is the arrow of time. And this is the arrow of number of non-Christian people. You know. A previous generation of Christians were taught this. This is where you want to get to. This is ultimate sanctification. No non-Christian friendships. It's a good thing. Whole generation of Christians were told that. They were told that mixing with worldly people would do them an awful lot of damage. Holy people just steered clear. Now, even if you are not infected with that virus, even if you've not got that in your head, this is what happens over a period of time. When you first become a Christian, you know loads of non-Christians. But over time, the non-Christians gradually get replaced with Christians. Because church life's a bit like that. It's very busy and hectic and home groups and all the rest of the stuff you're doing. And Christians are nice and easy. Did you say that? Oh, they're nice and easy and they don't swear and, you know, they don't cheat very often and all the rest of it. And over time, you just find yourself losing loving contact with people far from God. And so what happens after a while is that you don't actually have many natural opportunities to share your faith because you're not rubbing shoulders with people far from God. Because when you choose Christian. So if you were out for a meal, who are you most likely to go out for a meal for if you had a choice? You go Christians. Christians all the time. Sometimes you have no choice. Oh, you know, my family are coming. Oh, no, I can't wait till they leave. Because then I can spend more time with the Christians. You see, it's that kind of thing. Don't tell me, does your church run a Christian football team? No. Hallelujah. Because I meet loads of churches, oh, we have a Christian football team. You go, that's a disaster. Football can be played with anybody. In fact, there is a team in London. It was a Christian football team. It got banned because the pastor got more red cards than anybody in the whole league. Okay, they're that bad. You could play football with anybody. Right, so what you have to do, because this is what happens, just you have to intentionally work at this. So let me give you a little silly example. Up my loft, what do you think I've got? Boy. Toys. Electric trains, absolutely. Electric train set. And, you know, I've been dreaming about this thing. I've been getting the magazines for years. One day I'm going to build it. But up my loft, who would be up the loft? Me on my own. It would be great fun. Grandchildren are a wonderful excuse to build my model railway. But while I've got sort of air going through these lungs and I can sort of hobble, I choose to spend time with people. It's not at all. If you've got a model railway up the loft, come and see me afterwards. I'd love to find out more. But you see, my life is limited in time, isn't it? Time goes so fast. And it's perfectly okay to do a model railway or any other equivalent, like you could think, yeah, stamp collector, anything you like, you know, I don't mind. But in this one and only life that you can live, the one and only, Joni Erickson Tada put it like this, she said, "This is my one and only time to fight for the king. Soon I'll be dancing for the king. That's the thing I can't wait to do. When I put this body, which is paralyzed from here down, when that body dies, I can't wait to be in the king's presence. And when I get my new body, I will dance for the king. But this is the only time in my whole eternal existence I get to fight for the king. I want to fight as well as I can." And when she means fight, she means share my faith, live for him, contact as many non-Christians as I can with the love of Jesus. Now, I choose to do sporty stuff mixing with blokes. I could choose. It wouldn't be wrong. It's not a right wrong. You know how Paul says some things are good, but some things are better? And because this happens naturally over time, so when we had little children, we knew loads and loads of other people, because through our children, Jenny met just loads of people at Mums and Toddlers, loads of people around the school gate, until when? They go from infant up. No, your children will not want you to take them to school when they're 10, will they? They'd rather die than mum and dad come. So all of a sudden, you don't have that natural contact. We don't have natural contact through our children with anybody much now. See, it's all gone. This is what happens. So we have to intentionally, if you're going to rub shoulders with people, you have to intentionally. Now, what that will be for you, I don't know. It might be join the local neighbourhood watch. You can meet, good thing to do anyway, meet some people. It might be you join the local rowing club. It might be you do join the local, if you're going to do model railways, go and join the local model railway club, as well as have your one up the loft. You see, you can do both. You can. It is possible, I tell myself. But do you see what I'm saying? Now, with your own personality, you might be a loner. That's fine. There's all kinds of ways of doing it where you can. You don't have to be the life and the soul of the party. You don't have to be the person with the flamboyant stuff. You just be who you are. But you bias towards spending time with people than not spending time with people. So if you like reading books, join a book club. Now, okay, you read faster than they do, and they still, you know, they're on page 10 when you finished a novel last week or something. But you're meeting people, any chance to meet people far away from God. And you're amazed how many times God used those friendships, those conversations. If you're going to have people come to carol services, you need to rub shoulders with people, don't you? Sounds obvious, but enormous numbers of Christians don't. Enormous numbers of churches soak up all the spare time that Christians have. Church leaders have to intentionally create space and not fill it with ever more meetings. It's just one of the banes of modern church life. There's so much to do, just forever, ever at meetings. We have to intentionally work. Now we can explore, that's time. Second diagram is a space one. I'm a geographer, quickly, 2 minutes. Can this happen for you? Yes. You've got four spatial zones in your life. One of them is where you live, your home. Around you, there will be people. Even farmers have neighbours. They might be 3 fields away, but they're still neighbours. You have your leisure. And you can make choices, whatever shape you are. Even fishermen fish with other fishermen further on down the riverbank. You have work. Now, your work might be paid, it might be unpaid, it might be voluntary. But the stuff you do that brings you into contact with people. And, of course, at church, there's loads of non-Christians at church. There'll be people's kids. Ah. Now, I've heard that your church is pretty good at this. Somebody was saying it's just lovely to cuddle somebody else's baby. Jim was telling me. Brilliant. Say hello to the kids when you meet them. Never just, oh, kids. If you want a 15-year-old to start talking to you about Jesus, start saying hello to him when he's age 3. David Bath, I said hello to David Bath every Sunday for nearly 17 years. Never said hello back. Hi, David, glad to see you. Nothing back. Till one day he said, Ray, I've got a model railway. Oh, boy. David, you haven't. And we had a great conversation. And we have talked very deeply. But it took 15 years, okay? 15 years of saying hello to David and nothing back. Till he felt safe enough to talk to what he sees as, like, you know, ancient grey-haired Ray. But now David will talk to him about anything. Because I said hello to him for 15 years or whatever it is. See, so... And at church, there'll be people's spouses, there'll be visitors, there'll be people coming to things. Now, if somebody sits next to you who you don't know, God has put you there to say hello to them, hasn't he? When people come to your church, they are not visitors. They are heaven-sent guests. They never get there by accident. Heaven has been planning their attendance at your church for all eternity. You know that. You do know that, don't you? They have not got there because they want to get there. They have got there because the Holy Spirit has put inside of their heart, you've got to get to Avenue. They don't think that, but that's what we know is true. So when they come, what do you think a Father in heaven wants to do? Invite them and welcome them as if I was coming to your house today. Do you give people a welcome like that? Do you talk to strangers who sit next to you? When I was on my last sabbatical, I visited 35 churches. Every single one of them thought they were welcoming. Do you know how every church in the world... Do you ever met a church that says, we are the unwelcoming church? Exclusive brethren do, because they just, you know... We're there. Yeah, we got several of those. Big fence and all the rest of it. But pretty much everybody else says they're welcoming. Now, when you go on holiday... When you go on holiday, how many churches are genuinely welcoming? Not many.